Break out your wireframes and heat up those Git repos. We're ready to tackle topics ranging from accessibility to front-end design, user experience, and beyond. You're listening to the Drunken UX Podcast with your hosts, Michael Feenan and Aaron Hill. Hey, ladies and gentlemen, thanks for joining us here on the Drunken UX Podcast. This is episode number 93, and we're going to be talking about accessibility overlays along with CSS specificity, not together, but separately in different parts of the show.
They are related, though.
They certainly can be related, yeah. Much like me, myself, and I am your host, Michael Feenan.
And I don't have a good pronoun thing to follow that. But I'm your other host, Aaron. How are you doing, Michael?
I'm doing well after standing up to record this episode and then immediately almost falling down because my back decided to say, standing? That's a young man's game.
Some fish crawled out of the ocean millions of years ago and now my back hurts. What kind of bullshit is that?
Yeah, exactly.
How is that even fair?
You turn 39 and you suddenly realize you aren't quite as invincible as you used to be. And let me tell you, nobody warns you about that in sex ed. Yeah, and if you're enjoying the Drunken UX Podcast, go give a shout out to our sponsors over at Live at Manning. Coming up next month on August 3rd, they are doing another free live webinar coming up on APIs and API design. If you want to get a free ticket to that event, it is streamed on Twitch, and you can just go to drunkenux.com/apiconf. That's drunkenux.com/apiconf. Speaking of Twitter, I went out before the show started and just kind of asked everybody what you wanted me to drink this week. And when I last checked right before we started, the Four Roses small batch was winning 4-1. So
that's tasty stuff.
Going with that. Yeah, I like it. I'm not going to give you the whole breakdown of it. I've drank it on the show before, but
yeah,
I had a brand new fresh bottle of it. I had something else. I had really, honest to God, planned on drinking Aberlour 12 for this episode, and I opened it about 3 days ago, and it's gone now. Because...
Hopefully because you drank it.
Well, yes, I did. Yeah. I drank it entirely too fast, but it was... incredibly good. Like, it's not gonna blow your mind. It's not like mind-blowing out of this world like flavors or anything like that. It's just incredibly drinkable. And I fell prey to that a little bit. I've been working on my proton pack in the evenings and like sitting there with a nice glass of scotch while I'm putting in 1,000 screws that take forever. Well, that's the way it goes. So you picked it, I'm drinking it. Four Roses small batch this evening.
That's tasty stuff. I miss having a bottle of that.
You can buy them.
What?
It's allowed.
I don't have anything. My kitchen's getting renovated right now, and so everything I have is like stored away. I've been living out of to-go containers and microwavable food. So I have water tonight.
Well, you can always in spirit drink with us. That's fine. In spirit.
Or in beer. You can drink with us in beer.
Aaron, did yes. you happen to see earlier this week when we're recording this, this will be airing pretty quickly after we've actually recorded it. So this may still be in the Twitter space, but have you seen the Accessibee hashtag floating around the last few days?
So you sent it to me, and when you first sent me the message about it, I thought you had misspelled accessible, but I was like, I'll try spelling it verbatim just in case. And lo and behold, that popped up. And holy shit, it made me so angry. Is this the same thing that we talked about on that previous episode where like there was a WordPress plugin that like gave you like an accessibility overlay and we were like, oh, this is neat. And then Twitter was like, no.
Yeah.
Was this the same thing?
I had to eat a little crow. I think it was a few months back, if not farther. And I try to remember. I think it was when we were talking about the UX of campaign websites, political campaign websites.
Right.
I think I may be remembering this wrong, but we were looking at a website, and I remember they had an accessibility overlay tool. This is what an accessibility overlay is. It's usually a line of JavaScript that you add to your site. that puts a little badge in the corner, and you can hit that badge and it will do things like change the colors of the site, change the zoom, change the font,
right?
You know, invert colors, things like this, with the idea that it helps solve accessibility problems on the page. Now, if you've listened to us long enough, you know that we are huge fans of accessible design. Like, you should build it right from the start, ideally. We also understand that a lot of places don't understand that concept at all. You know, they're buying themes off the shelf or whatever. They're a little business, just mom and pop shop setting things up. They're not even thinking about that. And we get that. And so at that point in time, I'd gone on Twitter and I'd shared some of this. And I said, hey, at least they're thinking about accessibility and they've added this tool. It's better than nothing. To which I was very promptly corrected by many people that,
it's
oh,
worse
no,
than nothing.
Yes, like, these tools can frequently be worse than nothing. And, you know, that was something, like I said, I ate crow on it, well, and I immediately corrected myself after listening to the concerns, because they were 100% right.
We'll clarify what we mean by that shortly.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah. I did just confirm it was episode 73, campaign website accessibility.
Okay, it was
that. And that I checked, I saw it in the transcript that was the one we, it was like Barbara Boley, I think was her name. Yeah.
Transcript win.
Yeah.
Accessibility is usability. We just proved it. We solved the internet. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm taking QED. Off for the rest of the night. We're done. Thanks for listening. So what happened? Let me frame up what happened here, and then we'll talk about the underpinnings and philosophy of this. So Accessibe is one of these tools. There are a half dozen of these different tools out there. You might have heard of things like AudioEye or User First or Max Access. Like, these are all tools that do very similar things. And what happened was Accessibe is one of the more well-known, I think, platforms that does this. And the reason that they've been doing this for quite a while. This is not a new tool by any stretch of the mind. But what happened was, in this last week, they launched a national ad campaign that I think it launched on Hulu. I don't know where else it might be running, but I know it was on Hulu for a fact, and of course YouTube and whatnot. The commercial itself, honestly, and I'll throw it in the show notes if you want to give it a watch. It's not a bad commercial. Like, it's
It's the kind of inspiring content you expect to see from any ad company that you pay a lot of money to.
Right. The message was good.
Yeah. Yeah.
The problem isn't the message. The problem isn't the ad. The ad drew attention to them and drew attention of accessibility advocates.
I think there's actually two problems. There's the problem with the product, which you're about to mention, and then there's the problem with their response, which I think is like maybe the bigger one, which we'll also address.
So what happened was all of these advocates, all these people with disabilities, took to Twitter and started tweeting about it. There were a couple organizations that had recently adopted the tool who sent out tweets over the last couple days, and people like jumped on those tweets and said, please drop this tool. Here's all the reasons why. Like, there were a couple folks, and again, we'll have links to some of these articles and stuff in the show notes. There were some folks on some of these threads that went into extensive detail as to how these tools hurt their experience and their ability to use the websites. And
just to reiterate, these aren't like people concern trolling, which is what we would be doing because we are cited and hearing, et cetera. But these are people who actually are directly affected.
Yeah, these are legitimate, like, blind users, people using screen readers, low vision, people with motor impairment, things like that. So that was, yes, part of it. Where it really got interesting was there is a page called the Overlay Fact Sheet.
.com.
Yeah, overlayfactsheet.com. This was created earlier this year. I didn't look at the Git history to see exactly when it launched. I know like it was at least March, if not earlier than that. It was created by Carl Groves. If you don't know that name, Carl is the CEO of Tinnen.io. And Tinnen is one of the premier accessibility consultants in the country.
That's T-E-N-O-N.io.
And Carl has well-deserved respect in this field. He's incredibly smart on all of this and knows his stuff inside and out. He's worked at DayQ. He, of course, started this company. He's got a couple others, Level Access, I believe, he worked at one point. Like, this is a dude that lives and breathes accessibility. Carl is an absolute paragon in this industry as far as, like, somebody to go to. When he talks about accessibility, you generally want to listen.
Sure.
So, a friend that I know was commenting, and this is how it came to my attention. I saw them tweeting at one of these organizations and shared this and was like, hey, you should read some of these resources and people's experiences because it's not as helpful as you might think it is. To which Accessibility replied, and I am quoting.
Wait, which reply did you get here?
This is the first one here.
There's a bunch of choice ones.
Well, yeah. I'm going with this one. The fact sheet is an unofficial document created by our competitors, and we ask that you refrain from sharing it as it is misleading. There are many accessibility professionals and advocates who support Accessibility and use it to access websites. Now, first off,
we're not wrong. You're wrong.
Yes, exactly. First off, Tenon is not a competitor with Accessibility, at least not directly. Yes, they are both accessibility companies, but Tenon does accessibility remediation and training and education. Accessibility makes a product that they sell. Like, it's pretty different in that way. Also, asking people to, well, unofficial document. What would an official document, would it have to be something from the W3C?
This is one of those instances where a word has a negative connotation, and so they're using it to, like, appeal to emotion. So they're trying to say, this is a negative word, we're going to attach to this, we want you to perceive it negatively.
Yeah.
Official one. Official sounds like a good word. Unofficial sounds like a bad word.
Right.
My favorite part out of all of this was that they referred to Carl Groves as a manual coder.
I don't even know what that means. I don't even know what that is supposed to mean. Is that bad? I write code. Am I a manual coder? My code is not generated by AI. I don't know what this means.
I think that they were trying to, like, position that as being, like, opposed to their product, which automates accessibility stuff.
And the key phrase there that was also attached to all of that is, well, Carl Groves does not have an accessibility. So clearly he can't know this
disability.
Space. Disability, yeah.
Right.
But the actions of the company can't be ignored. And this isn't even like the first kind of weird thing that has come up. Over at WP Tavern, they noted a couple months ago that WordPress.org had to go in and remove reviews from the Accessibility plugin because they detected patterns of fake reviews on all of their stuff. And we're not talking about two or three. We're talking like it was like two dozen or something reviews that got pulled down because of it. And reviews that also, surprisingly, unsurprisingly, gave negative reviews to all the competitor plugins.
All right. So I think in this space that we work in this digital space, there's kind of like two ways to approach a product like this. One of them is you have a lot of experience in the area and your product kind of like evolves or grows out of that experience. It's like it's like sort of the capstone of all of your work. And that sounds a bit like what has happened with Carl Groves and his manual coding shop.
One of the problems I think that happens in this space in general, and when I say this space, I mean web, not necessarily accessibility.
Sure.
Because like I say, I made that mistake. When I talked about this originally and I said, well, it's better than nothing.
Right.
There is, I think, a very reasonable line of thought that can bring you to that point that says it is better than nothing. You can have a completely inaccessible site, or you can we can make a tool that will try to make that better. Like, there is a motivation factor there that is altruistic. It's just misled.
That's getting to the other type of company that I was going to mention, which is the kind that sees, oh, there's money to be made here. Let's go make a product and make money in this part. And that's what feels like is happening here. I don't know. This is entirely hearsay and conjecture on my part. I don't know if that's actually what's going on.
The best marketed snake oil is still snake oil.
Exactly.
And that's overlay tools in general are snake oil. Because you should always advocate for fix the base problem, create an accessible product to start with, and don't get in the way of people's tools. That's really one of the core problems that we see here is the reason overlay tools are so ineffective is because what's our favorite law of UX?
Jacob's Law.
Yes. People spend more time on everybody else's site than yours, right?
I don't know if that's my favorite law, but okay.
Oh, Christ. All right. Look, you got the answer right. Take the win, okay? You get an A.
Yes.
But this extends to people's experiences, you know, digitally in general. So when we think about if you are somebody who needs assistive technology, you already have that built into your computer. You already have that built into your browser. And so what these things do is get in the way of that. They disrupt that. They conflict with it and fight with it because they don't know that you're running a screen reader. There's no, you know, there's no connection between these things. And that's one of those realities that you have to come to realize. And I think that there's a matter of humility here that I could understand building something and realizing, you know, hey, I'm trying to fix this problem I saw. I think I've got a good way to do it. I've got this idea. Nobody's doing it yet. I'm going to make it. And then at some point, you have to realize, oh, no, this isn't good. Like, we went down the wrong path. We need to pivot this. Mm-hmm. And you have two choices at that point. You lean in or out. And they leaned in.
I think there's a third choice, which is addressing the specific grievances and finding a compromise on your product.
Well, that's leaning out, though. I mean,
okay.
You're either going to double down like they did and say,
right,
no, we're not wrong, you're wrong.
Yeah.
Or you acknowledge it. And that may mean dropping the product. It may mean modifying the product. Like, I honestly, I don't know how you would modify them to something like this, but...
I think maybe the modification that you make is one that, so if the issue is that it interferes with screen readers because of some parts of it, then identifying like, okay, can we remove those parts? Can we still have a product that maybe has fewer features that we can then go and expand on more later, but still have something that's functional? There's a lot of good positive PR that could come out of that. And I don't think they would necessarily have to lose anything except maybe some development time. But I mean, they could have come through this and survived it without like being discussed on our podcast.
No.
Like this could have been a very different discussion that we're having right now.
Well, all,
if they had,
I'm sure all 10 listeners will be very, very pleased with this. There's a survey, accessibility practitioner survey over at WebAIM, and they asked this question specifically about overlay plugin and widget effectiveness. And of the respondents, it came out to basically 67% said that the tools were not effective or not effective at all or not very effective. Mm-hmm. One third said they were either somewhat or very effective. What's funny about that is the way those responses change when the respondents have disabilities, at which point that unfavorable rating jumps to 72%, and the very effective piece of the pie is only 2.4%.
Wow.
So if you want, go check out, first off, overlayfactsheet.com. Check that out. If you are at an organization where an overlay of some kind is being looked at as a solution, that will give you some ammunition to push back on it. They've collected a ton of resources and links and articles, but they've also collected a ton of personal experience stories that explain why these things don't work out well. As of earlier, there were 528 people, developers, designers, UX professionals, accessibility professionals had signed on. They've got a little statement at the end of sort of commandments, so to speak, that you agree to adhere by in terms of accessible technology. If you feel like signing it, go fork the GitHub repo and add your name to the list and make a PR back to the original. I signed it. I have no qualms saying that because I modified my thinking based on the information. I got new information. I adjusted my way of thinking very quickly. Like, that's that was an easy thing for me to see. So go check that out. It will give you, like I say, it will be very useful. We'll have a couple other articles as well. There's another one from WP Tavern that talks about this. Forbes and UX Design has a really good breakdown of why accessibility automation technology doesn't work well. So go check those things out. Let us know if you have experience using those things, either as an implementation or as a user. I would be interested to know, you know, some firsthand stories if anybody's ran into those things. But I'll be interested to see what happens. I do know a couple of the companies that got called out on this where they were like, hey, we just launched Accessibility, because I'm sure there was some agreement of, well, you know, we'll promote you or something that we launched. The companies chimed in and are like, thanks, we're going to review this information and and reevaluate
good for them.
Our usage of the tool. Which,
see, that's a good response.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's easy to understand why you would want it. And that's where we get into the snake oil component, right? Mm-hmm. And that you'll have that 2.4% of people that say they are effective, and they'll lean on that in marketing, in messaging, and all of that to make you feel like, yes, these are good products. And because cognitively it makes sense to us, especially if we aren't in that population, it's really easy to understand how you can get into this and say, I can sell this.
Mm-hmm.
I could sell it. Like, I'm a damn good salesman. Like, I could sell this the shit out of this product. But
that's
I
when
won't.
Your market that's when your market is abled people who want to check a box and not people who need assistive
technology. And all of the marketing is geared towards that. One line, add one line of code to your website and solve your section 508, your policy 1210 problems, your WCAG 2.1 AA. Like, that's, you can go read the marketing on any of these sites and they all claim variations on this same exact stuff. They really push the one line of code thing, interestingly.
I think that might be the razor here for kind design that we've talked about on previous episodes. And I think that might be exactly why this is worse than doing nothing, because you're checking the box, but not actually like dealing with the issue that is meant, that the checkbox is meant to represent.
It's sold to you as an easy button.
Yes.
When a CEO looks at an easy button, and they can hit it for $15,000 or whatever. I don't know what the company's charge. That's not a reflection on them. I'm just throwing a number out. But when they see an easy button and think, well, I'm going to have to spend 6 months of salary, you know, that's going to be $40,000 of my developer's time or something like that to remediate all these problems. Or I get a $15,000 easy button.
Right.
I get it. Like, I understand the business decision.
You think that you've checked the box,
right?
And then users still have accessibility issues and you still get the lawsuit ultimately.
And I 100% guarantee you that every term of service, every contract you sign with these companies absolves them of any legal culpability if you were to get sued. I guarantee it.
Yeah, I can see that. So all these companies that said they were going to review it, they did the right thing. They're approaching it in the right way. And, you know, applause to them for that.
It's cheaper to build accessible products. Okay. Anyway, let us know what you think. We'll be watching this unfold and see where it goes. A shout out to Carl. Carl, we love you. So
I sincerely hope that this is resolved positively and that Accessibility can get a hold of themselves and produce a better product that does actually help people. Truly.
Yeah.
Truly
absolutely.
Do. Yeah.
Never want bad for anybody, but I will laugh when they trip and fall because I grew up on America's Funniest Home Videos and that's what you did. Got hit in the nuts. Got to laugh at it. God.
Okay, so the other topic for this evening, we want to look at CSS specificity and dig into how it works and why it works and what it means when you look at CSS and are trying to understand why doesn't something look the way I expect it to. Here's why.
I want to clarify, one of our audiences for this discussion is people who say that CSS is very, very hard or challenging, or they're struggling with it, or they're frustrated with it. This is going to help you.
Because CSS specificity is a very concrete concept. It's not abstract. It's a very thought out, like, you're going to realize, like, there's a calculation you do to determine specificity.
Literally.
Because here's the thing, right? When you think about CSS, if I have a link in the body of my page and I want it to look a certain way, I can, in any given moment, write 12 different ways to target that link. Guaranteed. If not more. For complex...
Challenge accepted.
Well, do it. It's easy. Like, I would argue that for any kind of complex page, there's probably a nearly infinite number of ways to target any given element. Not truly infinite, but I mean, you're probably talking about, because when you talk like exponents, it gets real big real fast.
At least halfway to infinity.
Halfway to infinity. At least. That's just a teardrop.
Yeah.
Because it made me cry when I first tried to figure out all this math originally. Back in the young beard's days when the beard had no gray in it. Okay. So let's start with exactly what specificity means, because there are three pieces of CSS that matter and sort of intermingle and intertwine. You've got the cascade, the C of CSS, right? That word means something.
Right.
You have specificity, which is not one of the two S's after that, but don't get it confused. And you have inheritance. There's no I in CSS at all, but inheritance is a thing.
CSI?
Wait, is that
what the TV show's about?
No. But it isn't CSI? Is that the one where they had like two people typing on one keyboard at the same time? Or is that in NCIS?
I think it's NCIS.
I don't watch either of them. I don't know. I know the meme.
That clip. Oh, God.
I just joked with a buddy of mine today about breaking out the tandem keyboard to speed things up. So, the cascade, right?
Mm-hmm.
How do we, or not cascade, rather specificity. How do we calculate specificity? It comes from a four-digit number that is used to resolve conflicts in the cascade.
Right.
And so let's start with the easy idea, right? What is cascade?
Mm-hmm.
I've got a style sheet, and I have typed into it a bracket, color, blue.
Okay.
And then 300 lines later, I say a bracket, color, red.
It'll be red.
Are you sure?
Wait, doesn't it go, isn't it like the last one overrides?
How sure are you of that?
Why are you doing a bracket color blue?
Because that's the syntax.
Oh, your bracket, you mean the braces.
Yeah, curly brace. Bracy boy.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't mean square bracket. I was not trying to spook you and mislead you on... I'm just, do you want to be a millionaire about this? Is that your final answer?
Yeah. I'm with you. If they're both the same kind of selector.
Exactly the same. And just A.
Exactly the same selector.
A.
And then I believe, in my experience, the later one gets applied.
Right.
Like it's overridden.
Yes. Because
the
cascade means when two selectors go a-walking, the last one does the talking. I just made that up.
That's
you can use it. So where specificity comes in is if I have two selectors, let's say I have a colon blue, or I'm sorry, bracket. You know what? I can't articulate this over and over. Color blue on a tag. Yes. And then
I got it.
Then I have a dot active.
Yeah.
And it's color green.
Right.
I have now written a more specific... I should have reversed those, actually. I should have a.active is red. And then later...
And then the general one.
Yeah, then later I say a color blue. Well, the color would obviously be red assuming I have the active class on my A tag, because it is more specific. Right. More specific wins. So that brings us to the specificity model. This is, I said, it's a four-digit number. Technically, it's a four-number number, because each number can actually be as high as it needs to be, 99. Like, it doesn't roll over. It's not like a base 10 number. It's really like four numbers, common to limited. But
got it.
It starts with from most specific to least specific, any inline styles.
Okay. That's like when you have an element with style equals quotes.
A and then style stuff. Tag on the HTML element, yes.
Right. Okay.
IDs.
And that's when you have like element ID equals foo.
Or in the syntax, like CSS syntax, a hash.
Right.
Downside. Right. Then you have classes, attributes, and pseudo classes.
And that's all at the same level there.
That's all at the same level.
Yeah.
And then you have elements and pseudo elements.
Okay, so classes, attributes, and pseudo classes, that's going to be like classes, like class equals, and it's represented with a dot.
Dot class.
Attributes. Attributes is the things like the source SRC on an image tag.
Right.
Or.
And in CSS syntax, that's represented by a square bracket. And then, like square bracket, rel equals.
See, that's external. What I thought you were talking about. That's what
I know. I'm sorry. I was not trying to trick you. It's coding podcast over audio. I know is hard.
Pseudo classes is when you have those represent sort of like silent states,
right?
States or like So colon hover if you're hovering over it.
Yes, exactly.
Or colon last child, I think is one. So there's like some sort of secret magic happening there.
And we'll talk about those in depth here in a second.
Elements is the direct selector, like the A or the P or the element O.
Yes. Now, the one way to break all of this is to use the bang important, exclamation point important.
Right. Right.
That immediately overrides everything. That restarts the cascade effectively. And the only way to override an important is with another important that's more specific.
Yeah. You can't add, I've tried this, you can't add multiple exclamation points to make something more
important. Only
one, important.
Yes. Only one ever.
Only one.
And you should use them very sparingly. Mm-hmm. I generally will make the argument that the only time you can really justify using it is when you need to override CSS you can't edit. So if you've got a WordPress plugin that brings its own CSS in and you don't want to like fork the plugin just to edit their CSS or copy it or whatever, you can write rules that are bang important and override those that way. Cause it's, you're trying to change default behavior that isn't your default. So let's talk here about pseudo classes and pseudo elements though, and how they factor into all of this.
I know what pseudo classes are. I'm not sure what you mean by pseudo elements, though.
So let's start with the easy one with pseudo classes, because you nailed them to a T, right? A pseudo class is a selector that defines state. So you'll see these as colon hover, colon visited, colon disabled. Right. There is one exception to it. Not.
Oh.
So whatever you put into not counts. But the not itself does not count towards specificity.
Interesting.
Yeah, so that's just something to kind of, asterisk that not is a pseudo class that does not count towards specificity, but what is inside it does count towards it.
Okay.
And so pseudo classes, we said, define state. They define like a quality about the thing that you want to target. Links tend to be the really common one. But the other one where you'll see this a lot is with forms and form elements. Yes. Because form elements tend to have a lot of states associated with them, like required, disabled, things like that. A placeholder visible, I think, is one. Mm-hmm. And so those count, though, as if they were a normal class, but they are in addition to. So if you said, like, dot form field, class name form field, colon disabled, that has a specificity of 0020.
One thing that's really fun, if you ever find yourself writing a lot of JavaScript to do on mouse over or on click or like anything that's like you're just changing the presentation or the display of visual elements on the page already, check out the hover pseudo class and the active pseudo class.
And focus.
You can do and focus. Yeah. You can do a whole lot with those. I at my job recently, I changed a, it was like kind of a modal display. There was like, you know, three or four different links at the top. And then depending on which one you click on, it would hide or show different elements within this collection of elements. And we were using JavaScript for it before. And I was like, oh, you could do this with just some CSS. And so I wrote up like some SAS stuff and then it did the same thing, but without using JavaScript. I'm pretty sure that all of these pseudo classes have like basically full browser support too, right? Like this isn't like, these are secret weapons, but not like not supported secret weapons.
I would not say like every single example of the pseudo classes will be definitely supported depending on what browser mm-hmm. you're using, but they are well supported. And
yeah,
you can always go to caniuse.com and mm-hmm. and check and see if what you want. And all of them, like the normal ones, hover, focus, active, disabled, like all of those are 100% supported across the board.
Yeah.
There's
yeah.
no risk at all. So those are pseudo classes. Pseudo elements, that's the one you said you weren't as familiar with.
Yeah. What does that mean?
So if a class targets a state, a pseudo element actually targets a space. So the classic example of this is before and after.
Okay, I have seen those.
Right. So like if you've ever used like a :: after and then said, you know, content link sign, right? Like
got it.
What you've done is you've said I want to target the space after this link. I want to target the space before this link.
I'm with you.
Similarly, you can target things like the first child. You can target things mm-hmm. like the first line. You can target selection, which is what you have when you see sites that have like changed the color of the highlight when you highlight text. Mm-hmm. They're using the selection pseudo element because it's targeting. While you could argue that being highlighted is a state of the text, for mm-hmm. the purposes of styling, it's targeting an area, like a block of known stuff. So that's considered the pseudo element. So pseudo classes define states, pseudo elements define things.
Cool.
Is kind of how that works, okay. Which is why the pseudo elements are scored 1 point lower than pseudo classes.
Got it.
Now, here's the real trick. Both of these use colons. When you write them in your CSS, you use colons no matter what to define these elements. But sometimes you see single colons, sometimes you see double colons. Tell me why.
Ain't nothing but a heartbreak?
Incredibly close. I mean, you might as well stick a star sticker on your forehead for that one. I mean, the only difference between what you said and what the actual answer is that single colons should always be used with pseudo classes. Double colons should always be used with pseudo elements. That's it.
Okay. It's
yeah, like I say,
I thought this could be like a trick answer.
Practically the exact same thing you said.
Yeah, basically.
The thing and the reason why this kind of comes up is it is a fluke of the browser that is not strictly enforced anywhere. If you use one or two colons interchangeably, I think for the most part, browsers will always interpret it correctly. Because the double colon syntax was added later.
I think that I've used first child as a single with a single.
Oh, I have 100% made this mistake.
Yeah.
Now, especially if you do this with like SAS or something like that, and you have Babel installed mm-hmm. and everything, and you're compiling your CSS, it'll fix all that automatically for you, for what it's worth.
Sure.
But it's one of those little just syntax things to know, just for the purposes of, let me use my word, I get to use my word, idioms, mm-hmm. the CSS idiom in this case. And it also makes it really easy to think about this in terms of specificity then. Because if you're scanning your code, You don't have to stop and think, wait, is first child pseudo class or pseudo element? If you write it correctly with double and single quotes, you can just look at that and know that, oh no, that's a pseudo element. We're good to go.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Two more pieces to this puzzle. First is smarter, just writing smarter queries. And I want to talk about this because it doesn't affect specificity at all.
Sure.
But it does, part of making sure that your CSS behaves the way you expect it to is writing good queries.
This is a power feature for sure.
Selectors. I'm sorry, I'm using the wrong. Yeah. I'm saying queries. Selectors is really the right way of saying it. This is, yeah, some...
Right.
It's. I mean, yeah, it's power user stuff, but is it...
Not power user, like power feature. Like it's, these will amp up your, the CSS behaviors that you create.
Right.
Because it gives you a level of control over where the styles are applied that maybe you, if you didn't know about these, you wouldn't have known this is possible.
Yeah. And so as a result, here's the thing. When you're writing CSS, you generally always want to try to write the least specific selector possible. Mm-hmm. It's more efficient. It's quicker. It compiles easier. It reads easier. And it makes for smaller files. So it's always good to try to write stuff as shorthand as possible. We have what are called combinators. Combinators. I am the combinator. I don't know.
Wait, before you go any further, don't write CSS where every single thing has its own ID. And like you're styling each thing with like one single style definition for each. I know that technically maybe is more performant because it like avoids specificity calculations. It's fucking ugly.
Yeah.
that's not how CSS is meant to be used.
There's an entire school of thought that would say you should never use an ID in your CSS ever. Like that's a thing. That is something people believe.
I have seen that. Not everything needs to be a class either. If you can get away with just doing an element selector, start there.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And then if you're like, oh well, not every link is like this. Okay, now you add probably another like a descendancy element selector, which you're about to talk about. But maybe it's a class then at that point. I only use classes when I have to. Like classes, IDs, etc., are all hooks. And you add the class or the ID on if you can't possibly hook onto it any other way consistently.
Yeah. What I really like for CSS and IDs is using them as a poor man's namespace. A way of saying, like, everything inside of this ID is a certain way and thing. And then nothing outside of that ID should be able to influence what's inside of it.
I actually have an article for my devs, armahillo.dev, my dev site, about doing that with Rails. Rails throws all of its CSS into one giant file, but it allows you to specify a CSS per like controller or per action. And what I found, though, is that you can do this auto calculation that will set an ID tag for your body, ID attribute, and also some class data for your body. And then that can be used as a hook for whether or not it should apply styles on any given page. So I kind of do the same thing you were just talking about, like the namespace thing.
So we've got these I genuinely don't know how to say this word. I say combinators. Combinator.
Yeah. That's right.
Because I mean, my brain wants to say combinators because it's from the word combine. combinators.
Combinators, correct.
So. There is one combinator you use constantly and you don't know you use it, and that's a space.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Anytime you use a space in CSS, all you're doing is saying this is any non-specific descendant of an ancestor. So when you say div A, you're saying all the A tags, as long as it's a descendant of a div.
If it has a div above it, it counts.
Anywhere at any point in its tree.
It can be div with a P under it, and then an EM tag, and then an A. But if you have nothing more specific than div A, then that will apply.
The next one you can do is the right caret, right pointing caret, right angle bracket.
Greater than.
Yeah, greater than. Thank you. That indicates an immediate child. So in this case, if you did div greater than A, what you're saying is, mm-hmm. I want to target all the A tags that are the immediate child of a div. So not mm-hmm. what you just said. If it's in a P, right. in an M, that doesn't count because it is not right. an immediate child then. Right. In this case, the P tag would be the immediate child.
Mm-hmm.
There's the tilde, the little squiggle boy.
Yeah.
If you said div squiggle boy A,
mm-hmm.
you're saying any general siblings.
What does that mean?
So if I said div squiggle A, I'm saying any A that is at the same level of the DOM as the div. So not inside of it. It's a sibling of
right.
it at any point.
Okay.
After. This is one area I would have to look to be very specific about this. I do think it has to be after it is the only condition.
How? Do the next one and then come back right. to this one.
So then, yeah, the corollary for this one is the plus sign, which right. is a sibling, but it's a sibling that is immediately adjacent to it. So if I did div plus A, it would have to be a div that immediately has a link after it. A better example of that is not a div and an A. It'd be something like an H1 plus P.
Right.
And then you could say, right. you know what? I want my lead paragraph. I'm writing articles. I've got a blog. My blog has a headline and then content. And you could say, I want that right. first paragraph of my content to be bigger and italic or whatever, because it's the lead paragraph. Right. So I would say H1 plus P. And then if I said H1 tilde P, I would target all of the paragraphs after the H1.
I thought it would be all the paragraphs at the same level as the H1.
Yeah, I mean after.
Are you thinking
after in the code, not descendant of the H1? Like literally, got just it, after it in the code flow.
Right. Because they'd be adjacent. Yeah. The use case I see with this a lot is on list items.
Mm-hmm.
Where you would like style, because you have a UL tag or an OL tag. And then you'll have list items that are directly below it. Sometimes you want to style nested lists differently. And so you'll use the immediate yes. child selector, the greater than.
That's a great example, yeah.
Yeah, like with flyout menus or like CSS-based yeah. like drop-down menus, they'll do that yeah, a lot.
Nested menu behavior is a really good case because they are meant to be nested. So, and because you usually indent them and margin them and all of this, yeah, that specific addressing of what is a child of what mm-hmm. is very important.
These can make a lot more sense if you look at the DOM inspector, F12 on your browser. We'll open it in most browsers. When you're looking at that, like the descendants are the things you have to open the node, and then it's the first thing is the like direct descendant, and then adjacent will be anything that has the same like caret level, like it's directly below without having to expand anything.
I should probably, yeah, I guess we've gone this whole way and I've never said how it's calculated, have I?
Yeah.
You were supposed to stop me, but the bourbon kept us going. So the specificity is super easy. So I said it's four numbers.
Right.
That each number is self-contained, technically. It's literally just counting.
Okay.
So it's the number of things that match those four.
Okay.
Four of them. So let's go back. Let's review before the pop quiz, right? I said sure. It's a four-digit number. What do you count in those four digits?
So there's inline styles.
Yes.
And then there's ID
yes.
direct styles. And then there's classes, attributes, pseudo classes.
Yes.
And then elements and pseudo elements.
Yes.
Okay. So if you give me a div tag.
So I give you just a div. What's
that? Would just be an element. So yes. I'm guessing it's 0001.
Correct. The zeros matter. Okay. I mean, the zeros don't really matter, but they definitely help for cognition's sure. standpoint. Yes. 0001.
Right.
Okay. So let's say, okay, so we got the div. Let's say we want to style all the divs or all the A tags in a div. And I say div greater than A.
Mm-hmm.
What's that specificity?
Okay. So we're asking the specificity of the A specifically, right? Because that's the one that's being styled.
Well, the specificity is of the selector.
Okay. So there's two elements. And then there is a, that is.
Combinator.
Yeah. How does that affect that?
It doesn't.
Okay. So then
oddly enough, combinators do not affect specificity at all, even though you, okay, would, so you would think they would, but they do not.
So it would just be 0002.
Two. Yes. Good okay. job. Okay. Let's make it harder now. Let's okay. say, let's say we want div, but we want, the, only the first child A. We don't want to style all the A tags. We just want to style the first one.
Okay.
Okay. So div A colon first child.
First child. So that's going to be the first child is going to be a pseudo class because you only did one colon there. So it's going to be 0012.
Yes.
I guess.
Okay. 0012.
So in that case, because the third quantity or whatever is a, has a number, that one takes precedence. Right?
So yeah, so now we've got two selectors here that will target a link inside a div. But this third one that we just said will override the one we just did because, yes, now its specificity has gone up. Okay, now we're going to get hard.
Okay. Just gave me a doozy here.
I know. Okay, so follow along with me.
Okay.
Body, div, hash main.
So div hash main.
A, colon, not, colon visited.
Okay.
Dot first.
Okay, so to clarify, the div hash main is a div with the ID main, right? Yes. Not div with an ID main under it.
No space. Now keep in mind, space is a comparator. Right. Or, I'm sorry, a combinator. And combinators do not affect specificity.
Right, but this is meaning the div is ID main.
Yes, the div is ID main. Div
containing something with ID main.
But it would still have the exact same specificity if I put a space in there and said div space hash main. The specificity is still the exact same, even though I've technically added a layer of depth in the DOM selector that way.
Got it. Okay, so let's see. I am seeing, we're going to start with inline. There's no inline styles here.
No inline styles.
We have one ID, so the number is 01. And now with classes, attributes, and pseudo classes, we have dot first. So that's a class.
Yes. And I tried to trip you up. I tried to make you think that was something else.
but colon visited is a pseudo class. So that's going to go into the same group. So it looks like 012, and then elements and pseudo elements. We don't have any pseudo elements, but we do have body, div, and A. So it looks like 0123 is my guess.
0123. That is very good. Nice. I have trained you well. You will be a front-end developer yet.
Yes. I would want to point out the colon not. I remember you saying earlier that we don't count those.
Colon not does not count. Yes.
Right.
I tried to make it complex. So that's how this works. That's the process that you go through. There are, we will have in the show notes a link to, like, if you want to see this in action, there's a color syntax highlighted specificity calculator. So you can type in your selector into their deal and see what the calculation of it is.
Cool.
And so you can test yourself on it. Take some selectors you've written, write down what you think the specificity on them is, and then plug them into that tool and see if it matches.
Mm-hmm.
And then this all comes back to how do you make sure you're writing CSS? Because the other thing is, there's no reason to write overly specific CSS.
Right.
As long as you are properly styling things that are descendants of other things. Because one thing this gets into, we didn't talk about it a lot, because it doesn't affect specificity, is inheritance.
Right.
But only certain CSS properties inherit. Frequently, that's things like font size, color, font face, but not spatial things like padding and margin and borders, for instance.
I'd never really thought about that. Like, I know it intuitively just because I've done this for so long, but I've never really like considered about that as being a rule.
Yeah, that's when you see this gets into like a deeper talk about CSS, and when you see autocompletes that you're typing in something like color colon, and one of the first options is like inherit. Or initial, or unset. Like, there's all these other like CSS properties you can apply. That what these things do is they deal with specificity because they will reset things to different states based on what you've selected, or inherit. Like if you're inheriting something, you're saying, I want the value for this that my parent has. And so like specificity is certainly involved in it, but it doesn't directly impact it. That's more of just knowing your CSS selectors and or attributes and properties.
Right.
So I hope that was helpful. I hope that that like explains a little bit about how specificity works and how it affects your CSS. Do check out the articles. We'll have a couple MDN docs that explain this in really good detail. They will list out, like when you get into pseudo classes and pseudo elements, there are lists of those so you can see exactly which ones are which and how then they would affect your stuff. And then definitely check out the specificity calculator. And check out the articles over at CSS Tricks and Slicejack that we'll have linked as well. Are APIs on your mind? Listen to expert speakers discuss API design patterns, effective development methodologies, and the latest tools for designing amazing APIs at the Live at Manning API Conference. They're streaming on August 3rd from 12 to 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and you can sign up for a free ticket on Twitch by going to drunkenux.com/apiconf. That's drunkenux.com/apiconf. Well, I hope this was helpful. I hope you learned a little bit between either the specificity stuff or the accessibility overlay stuff. Normally, we would have this as like a warmer topic than the whole topic, but as I went into this, I thought, no, this is going to be a twofer. Like, you're going to get a double bang of different topics in this episode. So I hope that was helpful. Let us know your experiences with whether it's accessibility overlays or accessibility in general and how you approach, you know, avoiding the need for them. Or how you've maybe tackled the subject if it's come up at your organization and they've said, hey, we want to go get this tool. And you said, no, please don't. I would love to hear how you did that. And let us know how you work on CSS and how you've dealt with specificity and what your approach is, making sure you don't overload your specificity.
Specifically, you should come and talk with us on Twitter and Facebook.com/DrunkenUX and Instagrams.com/DrunkenUXpodcast. And also come talk to us about CSS specificity and other things at drunkenux.com/discord.
And don't get like overwhelmed by things like specificity. And it sounds like it's a lot of math, but it really isn't. It's just counting your elements. We lean really hard on the cascade part of things and the inheritance model of CSS, but not as much on that specificity piece, except when we are staring at the damn inspector trying to figure out why my color not changing on this element that I want to edit.
That's something that I think I've just learned intuitively through like practice, but knowing the specificity thing will be helpful in I may actually use this going forward, so this is cool.
But it's easy to know like the abstract part that IDs are more specific than classes, are more specific than elements. It's when you really get these like hybrid compound selectors where these things are mashed up. That's where it starts to get hairy when you run into these problems of stuff not overriding properly. So I hope that that's helpful. And I hope that you take some time to learn about it, because it's one of those things when you start to realize how the technology actually works, it makes you better at using that technology. So if there's anything I can leave you with, I hope that at the end of the day that you think about this, you think about the accessibility overlays, and realize that at all these problems we talked about, especially with the overlays, can be solved by so many different approaches, whether that's dealing with CSS in the right way, thinking about the way you're articulating those selectors in that code, working with users, doing your user research, and making sure you keep your personas close and your users closer. Bye-bye.
Bye.